You're listening to Aperitivo, first broadcast on the 28th of October 2013 on Monocle 24. Aperitivo, brought to you by the Glenlivet. Hello from Midori House in London and welcome to Aperitivo, coming to you live from Studio One and from just down the road at the Monocle Cafe. I'm Steve Bloomfield. On today's programme...
Georgian people can be proud of the democratic steps they have made. I encourage the country and all the political and civil society actors to continue moving forward without dwelling on the past.
Georgian elections, Palestinian prisoners and NSA spying. Daniela Peled and Ben Judah are here to review the day's top stories. Monocle made a weekend visit to the Atlantic Dialogues conference in Rabat. Andrew Tuck returned with a tale or two.
A huge ship may only have like 14, 20 members of crew on board. So the relationship between port and city is being broken down, even at the colourful level, and this is a very colourful level, of the number of prostitutes in a port.
We'll also head to the Monocle Cafe to meet the curator who's bringing the UK's Sistine Chapel to London. All that, plus a song from Lou Reed and a look ahead to the rest of the day here on Monocle 24. That's Aperitivo with me, Steve Bloomfield, starting right now. So, as ever, rather a lot to pack into the next hour here on Aperitivo. But before all of that, here's David Spencer with the latest news headlines.
Thank you. Monocle 24 News, I'm David Spencer. The US ambassador in Madrid has been summoned to Spain's foreign ministry following reports that the US National Security Agency secretly monitored 60 million phone calls in Spain in a single month. The latest claims are based on more documents released by the security whistleblower Edward Snowden. An EU delegation is in Washington to meet members of Congress to discuss the issue. Last week, there were claims of mass spying in France and allegations German Chancellor Angela Merkel's phone was monitored. Security sources in Egypt say three policemen have been killed in an attack on a checkpoint in the Nile Delta city of Mansoura. Three masked men in a car and one on a motorcycle approached the checkpoint before dawn and opened fire on the officers. No group has claimed responsibility for the attack, but Al-Qaeda-linked Islamist militants have stepped up attacks on soldiers and police since the army toppled Islamist President Mohamed Morsi in July. Israel is set to release 26 Palestinian prisoners in a second stage of a deal brokered by the United States in peace talks that resumed in July. Israel has said it would free 104 inmates over four stages as part of the negotiations, which followed a near three-year hiatus following disputes over Jewish settlement construction. On Sunday, a move by some Israeli politicians to prevent further releases was blocked. Israeli government spokesman Mark Regev said Israel has agreed to release the prisoners in an effort to advance peace talks.
This decision by the government of Israel is not an easy decision, on the contrary. To release the murderers of innocent civilians is a painful and difficult decision, which we are taking only because we want to give the peace talks with the Palestinians a chance. It's high time the Palestinian leadership was also willing to make difficult choices for peace.
British security group G4S has denied that its workers had electrocuted and drugged prisoners at South Africa's Mangaung prison, the maximum security facility it ran before the government stepped in to restore order earlier this month. The Wits Justice Project said some prisoners were forcibly injected with antipsychotic medication and subjected to electric shocks. But G4S said it does not use any form of torture or shock treatment. The abuse allegations follow other scandals at the British company, such as failing to provide enough guards at the London 2012 Olympics and discrepancies in tagging prisoners in Britain. The doctor convicted of manslaughter for administering a lethal dose of anaesthetic to Michael Jackson has been released from a Los Angeles prison after serving half of his four-year sentence. Conrad Murray was convicted in 2011 of involuntary manslaughter after a high-profile six-week trial. Prosecutors successfully argued that Murray was grossly negligent in administering propofol, a drug that was used to help the singer sleep. Pope Francis has met with Burma opposition leader Aung San Suu Kyi at the Vatican. On Sunday, Suu Kyi finally collected her honorary citizenship of Rome, 19 years after being offered the honour. The 68-year-old spent most of the past two decades under house arrest after a military government ignored the results of a 1990 election won by her party. Suu Kyi said the talks had touched on efforts to build a better world.
The Holy Father made a point with which I couldn't agree more, that such emotions as hatred and fear, they diminish the lives of people, they diminish human worth, and we need to build on the more positive emotions such as love and understanding and the desire and the will to work together towards a better world.
That's the latest news on Monocle 24.
David Spencer, thank you very much indeed. You're listening to Aperitivo here on Monocle 24. We're right back after this.
London, Toronto, Tokyo.
Hong Kong, Zurich, London.
Londres, Toronto, Tokyo. Essa é a Monocle 24.
Hong Kong, Zurich, London. Das ist Monocle 24.
Hong Kong,
Zurich,
London.
Esto es Monocle 24.
Hong Kong, Zurich, London. To via Monocle, 26 Cheche.
From London.
London, Caracas.
This is Monocle 24.
It is 18:06 here in London, 13:06 in New York City, and you're listening to Aperitivo here on Monocle 24, coming to you live from Midori House. Joining me now with their take on today's news is Danielle Pellad, editor at the Institute for War and Peace Reporting, and Ben Judah, research fellow at the European Stability Initiative and author of Fragile Empire, How Russia Fell In and Out of Love with Vladimir Putin. Welcome to the show, both of you. Let's start in Georgia, where an ally of Prime Minister Bidzina Ivanishvili has won the presidential election with 64% of the vote. This means an end to a decade in power for the often controversial president Mikhail Saakashvili. Ben, if I can begin with you, where did it all go wrong for Saakashvili? Because the story that, you know, many people in the West will think of when it comes to Georgia is that this was the man who brought in the Rose Revolution, the one who was going to change Georgia into a Western-facing nation. And this is, you know, two crushing defeats in the space of 12 months for him.
Well, Saakashvili always concentrated on the bigger picture. Saakashvili was interested in Georgia's place amongst the nations, Georgia in moving towards the EU, moving towards NATO. He was interested in making Georgia known about and talked about in Washington. He wasn't very interested in the economy. He wasn't very interested in the boring nuts and bolts of alleviating poverty. He loved like grand symbolic things like replacing all police stations with glass boxes so you could see inside to eliminate corruption.
That's not a bad idea.
But he wasn't interested in the price of food. And if you looked at all of the key stats, Georgia basically flatlined throughout the period. You had big economic growth, but in people's incomes, poverty, especially rural poverty, people weren't feeling as much of a change as he promised. The big issue that lost him the last election was that there wasn't enough reform of what was going on in prisons. And you had a series of shocking prisoner abuse videos that made the crucial intelligentsia and kind of urban classes in Tbilisi think that not enough had changed. And despite the democratic rhetoric, Saakashvili actually resembled some of the old flamboyant authoritarian leaders in Georgia's history a little too much.
Daniela, talking of big, bold flourishes, you went to Batumi, a city on the Black Sea, which was seen as a... Saakashvili wanted to turn this place around, didn't he, and turn it into sort of, you know, their version of the Adriatic. And it was big and bold and a little bit brash.
Just a little bit brash, yes. I mean, Batumi really encapsulated the whole Saakashvili project. It was going to be all about Europe. It was going to be a European resort, one where Europeans from the west of Europe and the east would come and frolic, where the Iranians would come and celebrate Nowruz, be a hub of international investment conferences. It would also have some lap dancing clubs. And
because you need that if you're going to be seen as European.
Absolutely, and lots of gambling. You know, it was all over the place, but it very much encapsulated that idea that this was going to be all about all about the West, or some perception of what the West would be like. It was going to be glitzy, it was going to be European facing. Did that really trickle down to the rest of the country? I mean, the Batumi is one city, but the regional unemployment rate was nearly a quarter, it was nearly 25%.
And yet, Ben, when we look at, you know, the big sort of, you know, the opposition group that's now running Georgia, you know, Georgian Dream, run by Bidzina Ivanishvili, he, in a sense, as a personality, I mean, the fact is he is a personality, is sort of even more over the top and even more, far richer. He's a billionaire. It doesn't seem like, you know, Georgian voters have turned towards, you know, the sort of staid technocrat who might sort of be able to do the boring stuff well.
Ivanishvili is, just to give you a little more colour on what a personality this is a man who lives in a Bond villain style lair above Tbilisi and who has a collection of not only Gilbert and George photo prints on his wall, but zebras, because every man needs a few zebras to entertain.
Has he got tigers as well?
Tigers, or is that just a rumour? Ramzan Kadyrov, the Chechen warlord who rules the province over the mountains, favourite trick. Ivanishvili, one of the allures that he had was his enormous wealth. It's over 20% of the total Georgian economy, and he created a $6 billion private equity fund, which was sold to the Georgian people as the miracle cure to their economy with $1 billion of their own money. And what I found so, in a sense, shocking after the election results came in, is that Ivanishvili said that if the Georgian people had not elected his preferred candidate for the post of president with 60% of the vote, he would have deemed them ungrateful and resigned from politics and stopped pumping money into that. And it reminds me of one of my favourite comments from the Russian novelist Vladimir Sorokin, which is that technology doesn't actually modernise people. Sorokin said that officials all over the post-Soviet space are profoundly medieval men that do medieval things with iPads. They organise tribute on Gmail. They organise executions by WhatsApp. They demand that people pay homage to them through satellite TV. And I thought that statement from Ivanishvili is not the statement of a Democrat. It's the statement of a patron.
No. And then, Daniel, I mean, where does this leave the Rose Revolution? Let's imagine those words in inverted commas. I mean, is it, you know, when we look at the state of democracy in Georgia, was perhaps too much hoped too soon?
I think talking to Georgian activists, one of the things that really annoyed them about Saakashvili is his insistence that Georgia was now a democracy. Well, really, it's far from that. And I mean, trying to think of something positive about presidential elections, I mean, I've been observing, following the competition. Actually, it's been civilized to the point of being boring.
Well, really. That's a good thing. That's a step in the right direction.
Which really is, it's, you know, that's what we should aspire to.
And the observers that we heard from at the top of the show as well, they've said actually, yeah, this has been run relatively fairly.
Yep, and previous Georgian presidents have all been booted out of office. So that's quite encouraging. And Georgia does need a bit of political stability because the rivalry, the enmity or hatred between the president and the prime minister was really leading to an enormous amount of uncertainty with all its economic consequences as well.
Let's talk about those economic consequences. I want to come back to the issue of Europe and Russia in a moment. But Ben, looking at the economic consequences now of this election, as you say, you know, the reason why Saakashvili wasn't as popular perhaps in Georgia as he was elsewhere in the world was that, you know, price of food he didn't really care about. Do you get the sense that the Georgian Dream Party care about the price of food, know about the price of food, and know how to deal with it?
One thing that Georgian Dream has sold itself to the electorate as understanding is just how important it is to pursue an element of detente with Russia to try and open up Georgia's previous main export market for food and wine. One of the reasons that Georgia's rural people really suffered was the lack of ability to trade with what was previously their main market. That often didn't show up so much in official stats because it was the grey economy, but that's one lesson that Saakashvili didn't learn. There's a more pressing issue here, which is the political one, which is the former defence minister in the Saakashvili government has been jailed. The former PM from the Saakashvili government is being held in custody. And a question mark hangs over whether or not Ivanishvili and his minions will now jail Saakashvili. And if that happens, the doors of Europe will slam firmly shut in the face of Tbilisi, whoever is in charge there. Commenting on this, Ivanishvili has said that, well, like Berlusconi faced trial, Sarkozy was called in for summoning. I don't know if he's going to be called in.
You know, hardly filling you with confidence, is it?
Well, he sounds like Putin, because those are the excuses that Putin always uses about the people that he's jailed, that he doesn't really understand, and that's how law works. But this is a very worrying thing for Georgia's dreams and future.
And Daniela, I mean, when Saakashvili was, when he was inaugurated, first time around, he played the Georgian national anthem, and then he played the EU national anthem. I say national anthem, but he played the EU anthem, the Ode to Joy. I think it's going to be a surprise if Georgi Margvelashvili does the same. Do you get a sense that sort of Georgia's opening up to Europe is perhaps coming to an end?
Yeah, I think that's pretty much fair to say. I mean, this administration has really reversed the previous policy regarding Russia, and it's an rapprochement with Russia. Although there is still, this is not by any means something that all of Georgian society is happy about. I mean, a case in point is the Sochi Olympics. Now, Saakashvili said, no, we're going to boycott it. This was reversed just this May. But already there's a growing anger that Georgia is expected to compete there, and the Georgians expect to be humiliated there. There was a recently, in the torch bearers parade, the Olympic torch, Russian TV highlighted, in fact, one of the torch bearers was a Russian pilot who was handed the country's most prestigious honour for bombing Georgia during the war. That's hugely insulting.
Ways to make friends with your neighbours during the Olympics.
Exactly. So Georgia is saying, well, in Russia, it's saying that South Ossetia and Abkhazia are part of, you know, they're independent countries, and there's no debate on that. So where does that leave us?
Okay, let's leave Georgia and its state of democracy and turn to a little bit further west to Europe. It seems like every day now there's a big story in a major European newspaper saying its leader or maybe its citizens have been spied on by the NSA. And today, congratulations to Spain. You are today's NSA winner. El Mundo this morning revealed that 60.5 million phone calls were intercepted in Spain between 10th of December 2012 and 8th of January this year. Last week we heard that there were 70.3 million French phone calls that had been intercepted, or the data on them had been intercepted in some way. That was in Le Monde. Daniela, do you worry at all that we just get a little bit fatigued by this day after day and think, oh God, well, it's Spain this time. What a surprise, because it was France last time. Or do you think it actually just underlines how serious this whole thing is?
Well, you could say, you know, this time it's personal, because it's one thing collecting great amounts of amorphous anonymous data. But when you're actually talking about listening to Angela Merkel's mobile phone, well, that's taking it a little bit far. And although Europe and America, neither side really want a confrontation over this, there's far too much at risk. There's no choice, really, when it comes to that. When it comes to your mobile phone details being on a database, really, that's when it becomes personal.
And Ben, looking at this from a broader point of view, do you think, you know, when you, what do you think this is going to impact on in terms of the way the rest of the world sees America as more of these drip out week after week?
I think it's worth remembering, though, that most terrorist attacks that hit major Western targets are not actually planned in the Middle East. They're planned in Europe. And 9/11 was planned in Germany. So before we look at this data with a sense of bafflement, I think it's worth remembering that there is something the NSA is doing. The flip side of it, and what I think would be really interesting, is what the other European intelligence services have long been angry about is that they're excluded from Five Eyes, which is the Anglo-American Intelligence Consortium. And the smart move here for these countries would be to demand membership of Five Eyes. And this is one proposal I've heard.
So rather than sort of gesticulate and grandstand, to actually say, okay, fine, in return for us not making a meal out of this, you give us access to Five Eyes.
That's one proposal that was mooted in Berlin, which would be the smart reaction from Germany to deal with this.
Daniela, you were frowning when Ben said, let's remember that, you know, a lot of terrorist attacks are planned in Europe.
Yeah, absolutely. But then let's remember that there's also part of the European intelligence agency's responsibility to see what's going on in their own backyard. I mean, I don't think that's what the NSA, how the NSA is justifying its...
I mean, it's part of the problem here, surely, just it's the scale of this and the fact that you look at 60 million phone calls and think, well, what is it that you're looking for here that, that requires 60 million phone records? And that's in 1 month. So, I mean, we can't really extrapolate over the course of a year, but sod it, let's, you know, 60 times 12, you know, that's 720 million over a year.
I'm not sure that they actually even know yet. I think that the technology has overtaken... actually, the ability to deal with this.
We can do it, so we will.
We can do it, so we can, really. And I think that's what the governments are trying to struggle with at the moment diplomatically. They're going through the usual carefully staged motions.
And in terms of what Ben's suggesting, that you know, they should just suck this up and think, what can we actually get out of it? Are the European governments, are they smart enough to actually think? And do they feel strong enough with their... with their voting public to be able to do that?
I think what's at stake now, for instance, is a transatlantic trade deal, which obviously needs side. Obviously, Europe needs that. But there has been talk from Germany saying, right, OK, well, we're going to negotiate that, but as Ben said, we're going to renegotiate some of the clauses, so we get something out of it as well, because it is also about America's soft power, America's image in the West. You know, you want to have... the deterrent, the prestige of having a great intelligence agency, but you also want some level of trust with your allies.
Yeah, and that's rather tricky at the moment. We're going to take a short break now. You're listening to Aperitivo here with me, Steve Bloomfield. Still with me is Daniela Peled and Ben Judah. In a moment, we'll be talking Palestinian prisoners and, if we can squeeze it in, chemical weapons in Syria.
Inspiring the likes of Charles Dickens since 1824, the Glenlivet may be the definitive Speyside single malt whiskey, but that's just one chapter of the story. Master distiller Alan Winchester is inviting the Glenlivet's global community of whiskey connoisseurs to help curate the flavours of their next limited edition whiskey, The Guardian's Chapter. To discover more, join the Guardians at theglenlivet.com. The Glenlivet, the single malt that started it all. Enjoy responsibly.
Culture on Monocle 24 is untouchable. Go on, just try and do it. Try and grab a handful of the top-grade cultural radio that we're dishing out and see if you can touch it. Well, exactly. Luckily, though, you can feel it. Feel the passion of the unusually button-bright presentation.
It's a fantastic contrast, and it's one of those ones that ask you to look at the brushwork, to look just at the canvas.
Feel the craftsmanship in the breathtaking live Midori House sessions.
You know, I consider myself an entertainer, so I'm really about communication. I'm not really about expressing myself so much as trying to communicate with people and bring them to tears or bring them to laughter or what have you.
Feel the lovingly hand-stitched production, and most of all, feel the love of art.
It's there, and it's true, but it's really only a small part of his work.
Feel the love of fiction, feel the love of film, feel the love of music, feel the love, generally.
It is the most extraordinary collation of works that you would never normally see together.
Why not invite me round? Culture with Robert Bound is a well-behaved house guest and a joy to entertain.
That's Culture with Robert Bound, premiering every Monday at 1900 hours UK time, right here on Monocle 24.
And don't forget that Culture with Rob follows us in about 36 minutes' time. Right now, though, you're listening to Aperitivo with me, Steve Bloomfield. Still with me here in Studio One is Daniela Peled from the Institute for War and Peace Reporting and Ben Judah, author of Fragile Empire, How Russia Fell In and Out of Love with Vladimir Putin. We're going to move now to Israel, where the Israeli cabinet yesterday agreed to release 26 Palestinian prisoners. The move is part of a US-backed peace talks deal agreed upon by Benjamin Netanyahu's government and the Palestinians before negotiations were renewed during the summer. More than 100 Palestinian prisoners are set to be freed across 9 months. At the same time, Netanyahu intends to approve a new settlement construction to appease hardliners, because they always need to be appeased. So, Daniela, what progress has been made? Is this something that we should celebrate and say this is inching along little bit by little bit?
I think at this stage it's about the process. The process is about the process. I mean, what's very predictable is the release of prisoners. That is going to be part of any moves towards talks. I mean, that's a given. Or any moves towards strengthening the Palestinian side. I mean, the prisoners who have been released, they're all been jailed before the Oslo Accord. So they've been in prison for 20 years or more. It's not a prisoner release on the same scale as we had almost exactly 2 years ago with Gilad Shalit being released. I think the Israeli public is used to this. It doesn't make very much of an impact on public feeling. What's important for Netanyahu, though, is to keep the process going. Doesn't want to get in trouble with the Americans at this point for letting everything collapse.
Ben, is it important for Netanyahu to keep the process going? I mean, I can see how it's important for John Kerry. It's important to a certain extent to the Palestinians because they are hoping to gain something out of it. Does Netanyahu really think he wants this to continue too long?
Well, I think there's a growing tension in Israel because of low-level violence that's been rising in the West Bank and over the past few months, that unless the peace process can be kept ticking over, being fed small amounts of Palestinian prisoners, there is a risk in a confrontation with the Palestinian Authority and a risk that if the peace talks collapse, Israel could be in a very dangerous situation diplomatically. So the Israeli newspapers were comparing the prisoner release to Netanyahu trying to take the pin out of a grenade of a small amount of people who've been in jail for the past 20 years. And another point, I don't think I agree with Daniela that the Israeli public are used to this. Like, Israeli TV over the past 24 hours has been back to back with interviews of the mothers and the brothers and the cousins and people who saw these guys blow stuff up. And it is very emotive.
They do that every single time. It's part of a dance. Everyone knows what part they're going to play in this. It's what you can't release prisoners. You can't even make a pragmatic move like that without having to justify it and saying, oh, it hurts, but we're going to do it anyway. A lot more prisoners are going to be released in any kind of peace deal. And what Netanyahu is really worried about, much more than any violence in the West Bank, is that the Palestinians will go back to the UN and international bodies and resort to a much more dangerous third intifada, which is that a non-violent legal process, saying, well, which they already started, saying, okay, we've got observer member status at the UN now, we've joined UNESCO, we'll join the International Criminal Court maybe, and that will have all kinds of consequences for Israel-Palestine.
And this, of course, comes at a time where Netanyahu is looking slightly warily at the US and thinking, well, they're making friends with Iran and they're trying to do deals on Syria. Are we going to be left out? Let's in fact move briefly to Syria just before the bottom of the hour. Bashar al-Assad's government has handed in a plan to the Organization for the Prohibition of Chemical Weapons, the Nobel Peace Prize winning OPCW, of course. They said that Syria's declaration was submitted 3 days ahead of schedule. So Ben, they handed in their homework ahead of time, something that, you know, frankly, most of us can't do. Should they be applauded for this?
Well, Russia is applauding them, and Russia is delighted with how this has gone. Putin came to power in 1999 at the lowest ebb of Russian foreign policy, when Russia was unable to stop the West or even influence the West's decisions to intervene in Kosovo. And Putin has systematically told the Russian people that when Russia is strong enough, Russia will again be able to stop the West intervening and just punching out any regime it wanted to, for example, like Cuba back in the 60s. And the saving of Syria is being sold to the Russian people as his finest achievement. So Lavrov has been making speeches which are basically for the Russian domestic consumption. It's important to understand that, commending Assad's move.
Daniela, does the handing in of this declaration mean anything at the moment, other than just the process, like we're talking with the Israel and the Palestinians, the process is ongoing?
Yeah, I think so. Similarly, it's the preparations for the Geneva II conference, which is supposed to be held in late November. That's a process about the process, so the diplomatic community can feel that there is a diplomatic process. Lakhdi Brahimi is at the moment in Damascus, having been to Tehran and trying to arrange and bring people to the table of this conference, where it's not clear whether Iran will turn up, it's not clear whether the regime will turn up, and it's certainly very unclear whether very much of the opposition will turn up. So, yeah, it's It's all about the process.
It's all about the process. Just finally, and very quickly from both of you, on this show last week, I tried to inject a small amount of optimism by saying, hey, look, there are peace talks with Iran. There are peace talks between Israel and the Palestinians, and there is some sort of process with Syria. Can I afford to be mildly optimistic? My guest on that show said, no, you're an idiot. But Daniela, quickly.
I would hate to say you're an idiot, Steve, but I think there's an awful lot of talking and very little action.
Ben?
Well, the person who's optimistic is Vladimir Putin, because he believes that these peace talks are evidence that the US is no longer able to force an agenda in Israel.
Brilliant.
Is retreating from any interventionist stance on Iran and on Syria, and that the Middle East will once again be a fair playing field for Russia and the US.
So me and Putin are the only ones that are optimistic, for different reasons, I hasten to add. Let's leave it there. Daniela Peled and Ben Judah, thank you both, as ever, for joining us here on Aperitivo.
London, New York, Tokyo. This is Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. Tu vai Monaco 24.
Londres, Nova York, Tóquio.
London, New York, Tokyo. Dette Monaco 24.
Londonist, New Yorkist, Tokyost. Se on Monaco 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. Monaco 24 des.
Londino, New York, Tokyo.
This is Monaco 24.
18:31 here in London. Plenty still to come then in the second half of today's Aperitivo. We'll head to the Monocle Cafe in a moment to talk with the curator who's brought the UK's Sistine Chapel to London. We'll discuss the Atlantic Dialogues event in Rabat, and we'll preview what's coming up on tonight's programmes. I'll also fit in a little bit of Lou Reed. But before all that, here's David Spencer with the world news headlines.
Steve, thank you very much indeed. An EU delegation is in Washington to discuss claims of widespread spying by the United States National Security Agency. The meeting with US officials comes amid more leaks from Edward Snowden, this time claiming that millions of calls were monitored in Spain in the space of a month. Security has been stepped up around dozens of people injured when a car crashed and caught fire in Beijing's Tiananmen Square. Five people died when the car veered off the road and crashed into a barrier. Authorities have made no comment on whether it was a terrorist incident. EU monitors have declared the weekend's election in Georgia positive and transparent. Yorgi Margvelashvili won the election, taking more than 60% of the vote, way ahead of his nearest rival. At least eight people have died across northern Europe after a huge storm brought high winds and heavy rain. At least four people have died in the UK, with deaths also reported in France, Germany and the Netherlands. The first Prime Minister of Poland after the fall of communism has died aged 86. Tadeusz Mazowiecki was elected in 1989 and one of the architects of talks that paved the way for Poland's peaceful transition to democracy. And British rock legend David Bowie has led tributes today to US singer and former Velvet Underground frontman Lou Reed, who died on Sunday aged 71. He described Reed as a master. Those are the latest headlines on Monocle 24.
David Spencer, thank you very much indeed. Yes, and we'll be having our own little tribute to Lou Reed later in the show. You're listening to Aperitivo. It is 22:33 in Moscow, 18:33 here in London, and 16:33 in Rio. Time now to head down the road to the Monocle Cafe. Today we meet Amanda Bradley from the National Trust. Amanda is the co-curator of a new exhibition at Somerset House here in London called Stanley Spencer, Heaven in a Hell of War. It's the National Trust's first major art exhibition in the British capital for nearly two decades. Stanley Spencer was one of the most acclaimed British painters of the past century. This autumn, a series of large-scale canvas panels, Spencer's Memories of War, will leave their permanent home in the National Trust's Sandham Memorial Chapel and head for the capital. It's all part of the lead-up to the 100th commemoration of the outbreak of the First World War. Over now to the cafe, where Amanda is with Monocle's Thomas Lewis.
Steve, thank you very much indeed. Yes, you join us here at the Monocle Cafe here in London, and I'm delighted to say that I'm joined now by Amanda from the National Trust to talk us about this extraordinary exhibition that's about to open here in London. Thank you very much for joining us here. Tell us a little bit about the paintings that people will see and about their place in British history around the war specifically.
Well, these paintings were painted by Stanley Spencer for a couple who were real enlightened patrons of modern British art. They discovered Spencer sitting at a fellow artist's dining room table, and they saw all his sketches spread over the table, and they said, "Stanley, these are fantastic. We want to build this castle in the sky for you." And so they, at his request, they built a chapel specifically to house his pictures, and they are all recollections of his wartime experiences. And unlike his contemporaries, Nash and Gertler and Nevinson, they're not blood and guts. They're about daytime routine, wartime, daily menial tasks. He started the war working in a hospital, so it's about scrubbing the floors, cleaning things, making beds. And then as he was posted to the Macedonian front, things like laying out his kit, getting changed in the morning, and it was these everyday things that helped him keep going and, you know, get over the terrible loss and destruction that he saw. And in that respect, they are completely unique in the history of British art.
And the home, Somerset House, where these beautiful paintings will be on display, is a temporary home. Give us a sense of where they're usually housed and the unique story around that venue too.
Otherwise known as the Biscuit Factory. It's a modern building which was originally the patrons had commissioned the architect George Kennedy to build this chapel for Spencer. Spencer hated George Kennedy's designs, and he managed to sort of get his way into everything to do with the design of the chapel, and he managed to get to the barons, the patrons, to ditch Kennedy for his own favourite architect, Lionel Pearson. And Pearson built what Spencer wanted, which effectively was a holy box, and it's a very sort of modernist building, and it came to be known as the Biscuit Factory, and Spencer said it's a bit crematorium-ish, which it is slightly, but it's very well suited to the pictures, and it's rather nice to have everything, the whole concept is as one, in, designed really by Spencer actually, from outdoors to in.
And the idea, the concept in Spencer's mind was based on Giotto's famous chapel. What's the link there, if there is, in capturing the sense of Britain at that time and the historical sense of Britain that Spencer was also trying to give a voice to?
Spencer loved the Italian primitive artists, and they were really important to him actually throughout the war, and he had some friends, Gwen and Jack Raverat, who Gwen was another artist, and they sent him little black and white art books published by Gowans and Graham. We've got one in the exhibition about Giotto, and Spence would hide himself away between the bathtubs to read these books, and his Giotto edition was particularly treasured by him. And so he decided he wanted to arrange the chapel as Giotto had at the Arena Chapel in Padua. And so you get these two layers of paintings with the predellas and then the arched pictures on top, and then a monumental altarpiece. And originally, Spencer's initial designs were much closer to Giotto's, with little vignettes around the edge, but he gradually adapted that to his own purposes. And a lot of people call it England's answer to the Sistine Chapel, but actually it's more like, you know, England's answer to the Arena Chapel.
And as the centenary of the war approaches, presumably one of the goals of staging this exhibition in London is to maybe start the conversation again with people across the social spectrum in London and further afield who will no doubt come to this exhibition. What do you hope that people who come and see these pictures in this beautiful setting of Somerset House will make of it? And what do you hope it'll say about the war and about the collective experience of that 100 years on?
Well, I hope that these pictures will show all people of, you know, all types and generations that you know, it's very much a personal side of war and how it affected individuals. You know, it's not about mass destruction. It's about how war really affected people mentally. I've been talking to psychiatrists from the MOD who have described to me a little bit about how the war would have affected Stanley Spencer. He was a medical orderly, and apparently medical orderlies are much more affected than your average Tommy because the concentration of injury and death was so much greater for them. And this was really a coping mechanism. I think there's a lot to be learnt for this element of stiff upper lip. You get on with your daily routine, you jolly well deal with it. And actually, I think that's a great lesson, actually, for us all.
And just finally, give us a sense of when the show opens and how long it'll run for and who you're hoping that'll come and see it.
The show opens on November the 7th and it runs through till January the 26th. And I'm hoping that people of all ages will come and have a look. I know that children particularly love Stanley Spencer and they love the eccentric details in his pictures and they can be enjoyed on many levels. So I'm hoping many, many people will come and enjoy them.
Amanda Bradley from the National Trust, thank you very much for joining us here at the Monocle Cafe in London. Steve, it's back to you in the studio.
Thank you very much, Tom. That was Tom Lewis there with Amanda Bradley, Assistant Curator of Pictures and Sculpture for the National Trust, talking all about Stanley Spencer, Heaven in a Hell of War. Next up, we're here with Andrew Tuck, all about his trip to Rabat. Stay tuned to find out more on this episode of Aperitivo.
The Glenlivet is the original Speyside single malt whiskey, and since 1824, its flavour has defined the region. Join master distiller Alan Winchester to determine the future of this historic distillery. Three new whiskies will set sail around the world, and members of the Guardians of the Glenlivet are invited to decide which will become the Guardians chapter. To discover more and write the next chapter of the legacy, join the Guardians at theglenlivet.com. The Glenlivet, the single malt that started it all. Enjoy responsibly.
And you're back with Aperitivo with me, Steve Bloomfield. The Atlantic Dialogues, an annual event for policymakers and private sector leaders around the Atlantic Basin, was held this past weekend in Rabat. Monocle was there. A little bit earlier, I spoke with our editor, Andrew Tuck, who came back chock full of business cards, stories and interviews with speakers from global security to diplomacy. Among those were Andres Rosenthal, a career Mexican diplomat, and Chris Hunet, permanent representative of Belgium to the OECD, who we'll hear from in just a moment. But before that, I asked why Andrew made his second annual trip to the event.
We were there because we were nicely invited to moderate one of the panels, which was about cities around the Atlantic Basin and what they need to do to kind of stay competitive. So it was everything from infrastructure on a kind of small scale, so you know, water supplies and electricity for, especially for perhaps the cities in the southern part of the Atlantic, and then also looking at kind of some of the bigger urbanism projects as well. But it's run by the German Marshall Fund. It takes place every year now in Rabat, and it's become a kind of talking shop for people all around the Atlantic to come and talk about everything from migration to security and now to cities as well.
In a moment, we're going to hear from a couple of the people that you met with. But before we talk about those examples, what sort of other people were there?
So it's very interesting. You know, there's quite a lot of literal military brass. You see some clanging medals and some nice striped trousers marching around. And you see a few people who have like people walking behind them who certainly look like security, making sure that nobody kind of interferes with them. And there are a few closed sessions that take place where they don't allow the media in, where they perhaps are talking about some openly about some more sensitive issues that they have to deal with. So it's a very good a meeting shop. And interesting, I think, because it is in Rabat, a large number of people coming from across Africa, from both Anglophone and Francophone Africa. So you chat to someone and they would be, you know, the president's chief of staff, you know, from Senegal, or they would be working in development in Namibia. There was lots of interesting people and lots of people who did actually only want to talk to you off the record because they were doing advice to perhaps regimes that are are still struggling to kind of clean up their act. And people wanted to be honest with you, you know, especially around the subject of urbanism. I had a very good conversation with someone who's from Africa who said, look, you know, we've messed it up. We're growing at a rate that there is no way that we can sort out our cities. The only hope is in the countries where urbanism hasn't quite happened yet, that potentially we can learn some of the lessons.
There was another interview you did there with a Mexican former ambassador. Tell us a little bit about him before we hear from him.
Andres Rosenthal is now at the Brookings Institute. He's been, a deputy foreign minister for Mexico. He was the Mexican ambassador to the UK, for example, a very long and distinguished career in diplomacy. And he was there to obviously kind of put Mexico's case. And it's interesting, I was talking to him about what happens when you have a not distant neighbour like Brazil that's making such a noise in the south, doing so much work in Africa, opening so many embassies. And you're actually just as powerful as them in some senses with your economy growing and you've got good soft power prospects. You know, how do you begin to engage with Africa, with the rest of the Atlantic Basin? What is the future for brand Mexico on a soft power level and on a diplomatic level as well? So let's hear him.
What's most interesting from my perspective is that this is a place where you can hear some of the concerns that are in the minds both of North and South. Give you an example of the energy discussion that took place a little while ago. There was a lot of talk about alternative energies and about wind and about all of biomass, all of these things. And then one of the African representatives from Senegal got up and said, but listen, we have hydrocarbons and we don't know how to exploit our hydrocarbons. So before we start talking about alternative energies, tell us about how we deal with the energy resource that we have. I thought that was a very sort of, you know, bringing people back to reality. There are multiple instances of this, and it's a networking event. You spend a lot of time at lunches, dinners, breakfasts with different people in addition to the panels and the night owl sessions. I found it very useful. This is my third year, and I enjoy it, and I learn. And I hope I also give a perspective of Mexico. I just had a lunch. We talked about the new paradigms in the Americas, of an east-west relationship within the Americas rather than a north-south relationship, the differences between what's going on the Atlantic side and what's going on the Pacific side, the Alliance for the Pacific. These are all new things which weren't around last year. So it's a good opportunity to bring oneself up to date and to bring people up to date as to what's going on around in our region.
Well, I guess what's interesting for me there, Steve, is, you know, that this is a common theme that happened at the Atlantic Dialogues. He's picking up the idea that actually this north-south discussion, the idea that knowledge, wealth and power drip down from the north to the south, that game is changing. So just as he was saying, there's a kind of now an east-west dialogue in Latin America and they're looking to what's also happening in Africa. That was the same, I think, when I met many of the kind of the African delegates. What they were very clear to point out is actually they've learned some lessons now. People from Africa are currently being used as consultants in Lisbon. They're going there to say to people who are urban poor, this is how you grow food in a city on your rooftop in your back garden, so that when you're only earning 500 euros a month or you're on social security benefits, don't worry, Africa can tell you how to top up your diet. That's not happening in a kind of ad hoc way. People are going to Lisbon to teach Portuguese people. And also, Africa has become a home for many Portuguese people who haven't got jobs in the north. Hmm. So that relationship is completely being reshuffled.
Now, we've been talking quite a lot over the last few months about shipping. And when you were there, you spoke to people about how ports were changing, how they were adapting to this new reality.
We'll hear for a moment from the head of the Antwerp port. So he said, actually, if you count the number of ships now that come into ports, it's many fewer than it used to be, but the ships are that much bigger. But interestingly, that a huge ship may only have like 14, 20 members of crew on board. So the relationship between port and city is being broken down. And, you know, he was saying even at the colourful level, and this is a very colourful level, of the number of prostitutes in a port. No, this was a good indication.
Yeah, it's a good way of knowing.
It's a breakdown of the link between port and city. Guys used to come in, they'd go into the city, they'd drink a lot, they'd want to stay in a hostel, and they would, you know, sleep with women. Those relationships have changed. So what should the relationship between a port and its city be? And in Antwerp, 500,000 people, the bedrock of that city is all on shipping. So the rich people who 200-300 years ago bought great works of art, which they've given to museums. That's all because of shipping. The new museums are on land that was given up by the port as it moved slowly downriver because it couldn't cope with the size of ships. All those museums owe their money, are even named after shipping. So shipping is still the bedrock of everything, but actually people in the city of Antwerp may not see it on a day-to-day basis anymore. They probably never see a sailor. They certainly never kind of bump into a captain in the restaurant. So what is the link between the two? This gentleman is called Chris Hunet, and I apologise if I've slightly murdered his nice Flemish name, but here's him talking about ports and cities.
Historically, the wealth of Antwerp has come from the port, and that is still continuing. The port of Antwerp has grown a bit out of the city itself. Antwerp is the second biggest port in Europe, but at the same time, it's a small city, 500,000 people. But when you speak to the people in Antwerp, the heart of any Antwerp person will always be Antwerp and its port. It's inseparable. And one of the biggest symbols of it is, if you go to Antwerp, you may have seen that one of the things which has changed a lot, the old port has now completely been renovated. It has become a kind of what you find, for instance, like in Liverpool, the marina or so. It has become much more posh. It was a celebrated area a few years ago, thanks also to the investment of Port Authority. They start to give back the city to the people of Antwerp while the port is moving out. And the symbol there is the museum, the Maas, which means museum on the stream. And it is a kind of dedication on the richness of and the link between port and the city. And you can find a lot of historic elements, references, but also lots of cultural highlights between port and city.
That was Chris Hunet, the head of the Antwerp Port Authority there. And Andrew, we can hear more from the Atlantic Dialogues this Thursday on The Urbanist.
Yes, we've got a special show with lots of the people we met there. A good run through of voices from all around the Atlantic Basin.
Everyone you met there?
Not everyone we kind of met. We saw two other people who were... It threw me, first of all, because it turned out that the hotel we were staying in, Rabat, was also being used at the same time for filming Homeland.
And you didn't get a cameo.
I didn't get a cameo. So at breakfast, I thought, that looks like Damian Lewis. And then I thought, hold on, that looks like Claire Danes. So we were at the breakfast buffet, scoffing away, and there they were too. I must
Excellent.
Say Claire Danes wasn't scoffing at all. She was certainly in her gym attire.
Okay.
And she'd been on the treadmill, I think, while we were kind of there feasting on the Arabian delights.
Okay, well, so they won't be in The Urbanist.
No, but I won't spoil anything, but the hotel apparently had been turned into Tehran the day before.
Okay, so that's coming up later on in season 3 of Homeland then.
Yes.
There we are.
Producer, don't tell me off for leaking that.
Andrew Tuck, thank you very much indeed. You're listening to Aperitivo. We're back after this. And in a moment, I'll be joined by the producers of The Globus Asia and The Monocle Daily to see what's happening later on today on Monocle 24. But first, this is Satellite of Love by Lou Reed.
Satellite's gone up to the skies. Things like that drive me out of my mind. I watched it for a little while. I like to watch things on TV.
Lou Reed with Satellites of Love, Satellite even of Love. I've been joined by Aled John and Annabelle Bly, producers of Globus Asia and The Monocle Daily, to test what we have coming up. Aled, what do you got on?
Coming up at 8 p.m. London time, we're leading with the meeting brokered by David Cameron between Hamid Karzai and Nawaz Sharif of Pakistan. The backdrop to this is that, as is very commonly known, there's incredibly frosty relations between the two. Afghanistan believe Pakistan to be supporting the Afghan Taliban. So these talks are kind of aimed at jumpstarting potentially peaceful talks between Afghanistan and the Afghan Taliban because, as I just said, they're widely recognised to be supposedly supported by Pakistan. Slightly convoluted, but...
No, indeed. And it's interesting that they're meeting here in London as well. Also, we're going to be talking to Tristan McAllister, are we not?
We are indeed, yep. We're going to look at, these are reports, so they haven't been confirmed as yet, but we're looking at the potential for Emirates to buy a huge tranche of long-haul passenger planes, 100 worth, something like $30 billion US dollars.
Okay, and Annabelle, in the Monocle Daily, I'm rather excited about the interview with Alex Washburn, Chief Urban Planner for New York City.
Yes, it is 1 year on since the devastating Hurricane Sandy hit the US, and we'll be speaking with Alex Washburn, who was working for the city at the time and continues to work for them, and he's written a book all about his experiences of the hurricane and dealing with the aftermath of it all.
So we've got that coming up. Also, we're going to hear more of one of Andrew's interviews from the Atlantic Dialogues. And we're also going to be talking about the Colombian peace process, are we not?
Yes, we are. Steve, something which you probably know a lot more about than me, despite reading up about it.
That's a leading question.
Having spent a week there, yes, sort of with both the FARC and then the government side as well, which I think was in the October issue. Yes, the October issue.
Yeah,
which I'm sure you're giving to. Who's presenting tonight?
It is Emma Nelson and Victoria Graham.
Oh, brilliant. So just give them my piece to write to read. I'm sure they'll be fine. Okay, and we've got a few other things as well. We're in Toronto, aren't we?
Yes, we are. Art Toronto will be at a leading gallery, the Stephen Bolger Gallery, speaking with Stephen Bolger himself.
Brilliant. That's all coming up. So Globus Asia in just over an hour's time, Monocle Daily in just over 3 hours' time. Aled and Annabelle, thank you very much indeed. That's all we have time for on today's Aperitivo. My thanks in particular to our special guests, Daniela Peled, editor at the Institute for War and Peace Reporting, and Ben Judah, author of Fragile Empire, How Russia Fell In and Out of Love with Vladimir Putin. Among other things, we talked through the results of Georgia's recent presidential elections. Here's a bit of what Ben had to say.
A question mark hangs over whether or not Ivanishvili and his minions will now jail Saakashvili. And if that happens, the doors of Europe will slam firmly shut in the face of Tbilisi, whoever is in charge there.
Today's show was produced by Daniel Giacopelli, researched by Alexa Firmanich and Maddie Arouge. Our studio manager was Sean Malervi. Next up, it's Culture with Rob. He's going to be talking 20th century Arabic pop music, find out how to win a radio license in Toronto. I hope that doesn't mean he's off to Toronto. And he'll also meet a man who's been creating art in neon for 40 years. We're back same time tomorrow. For now, I'm Steve Bloomfield. Thank you very much for listening. Goodbye.
The Rolex Mentor and Protégé Arts Initiative sources young artists across 7 disciplines and brings them together with artistic masters for a year of mentoring. For mentors, it's a year to share their passion and expertise. For protégés, it's a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity to observe and work alongside some of the world's greatest artists. For Rolex, it's a chance to ensure the world's artistic legacy is passed on to the next generation. 1 year can inspire a lifetime.